This is Our American Stories. And when we talk about cars normally, we're exploring how they connect and free us. But of course, bad guys use cars too. But how do they choose? So we sent our death, destruction, and mayhem correspondent, Dan Dye, to look at how insurgents choose their vehicles in the second installment of the Curiosity series we call Ever Wonder Why?
ISIS. You've seen them on the news, but have you noticed this?
Their propaganda videos show convoys made up mostly of Toyota Hilux pickups and Land Cruisers. And now ABC News has learned that a U.S. Treasury counterterrorism unit is asking Toyota to help them determine how so many of its trucks, both newer and older models, have ended up in the hands of ISIS.
Now, obviously, Toyota is not so pleased with this, so they are cooperating with the U.S. government and others to figure out exactly how ISIS is getting their hands on these trucks, and of course trying to stop them. But let's break down the why part. Why these trucks? Why are almost all the vehicles painted light colors like white? Well, maybe it's cosmetic, but more likely, it's because the Middle East is hot. And when researchers in California parked two cars, one black, the other silver, in the hot sun for an hour, the cabin in the lighter colored car was about 10 degrees cooler. So, I guess we know why they're all white. But why does ISIS have so many vehicles, but so few makes and models? Well, that one's even simpler. Ask any organization with a fleet of vehicles, from a flower shop to the U.S. military, and they'll tell you that standardizing makes everything simpler. Your mechanics only have to study one manual. There are fewer different replacement parts to keep track of. And hey, when vehicles break down, you can use their remaining parts in other vehicles. Okay, so now the real question. Why standardize on the Toyota Hilux? Let's turn to one of my favorite episodes of Top Gear. Back in 2003, Jeremy Clarkson bought a red 1988 diesel Toyota Hilux with 190,000 miles on the odometer, all just to see if he could wreck the darn thing. To start, he drove it down some stairs and took great care to sideswipe brick and concrete buildings. When the truck laughed all this off, Clarkson rammed it into a tree.
This didn't really hurt it either.
Nope, still good.
Yeah, battery's good, radiator's good. That'll buff out. That's got it.
Failing to destroy the truck on turf, Clarkson went to surf. Specifically, he drove out to the waterline in low tide and let the truck get pounded by incoming seawater for, well, until the water receded.
This is the Severn Estuary, home to the second biggest tide in the world. 40 feet, and it moves at 8 miles an hour. That's why the RNLI have tethered my car in place. I'm not going to get that out for hours.
The lifeboatmen and locals thought it was all a huge laugh.
So that's going to drown my car.
Oh, yes.
Well, when will I be able to get it out again?
A few hours.
And it didn't turn up until the tide had gone out 5 hours later. The silt had jammed the steering lock and the cylinders were flooded with seawater. It was a wreck. And though we'd brought a mechanic along, we had no spare parts. Things looked bleak.
Well, the mechanic has worked on it now for 40 minutes or so, I think. And it's not looking good. Seems then that if you want to kill one of these things, the beach, the sea, salt water is the answer. Sorry.
Wrong. Astonishingly, the Toyota was not dead.
It started. Now, let's see if it moves.
So it had survived the West Country. But would it survive our test track?
And by test track, Clarkson certainly didn't mean the sort where you drive around in big circles for a while. Oh, no, no, no. His first test was to lift the Toyota high up in the air and drop it, boom, straight down onto the pavement. Then he drove it through a wood shed. And then he lifted a Mistral GT Caravan. That's a full-size travel trailer on top of the Hilux and dropped it. Now, that last one did bend the door frame a little bit, so Clarkson had to climb into the cab through a window.
Lordy, Lord, I'm too old for this.
And then he started the truck with the trailer still on top and drove off, literally shrugging off the massive load.
I honestly can't believe this. The steering's fine, the gearbox is fine, the low range box is fine, the brakes are fine. Even the speedo's telling me we're doing 30.
For good measure, Clarkson gave the truck a few whacks with a wrecking ball, the sort used to demolish steel and concrete skyscrapers, and then he threw a lit torch inside of the truck and set the whole thing on fire, which really just gave the Toyota a vintage look and a smoky smell. At this point, Clarkson called for reinforcements. His colleague James May found some buildings in East London due to be demolished, and he managed to lift the Toyota Hilux on top of a 23-story building rigged with explosives. When the building imploded, the truck plummeted 240 feet. And then this happened.
James, now we've seen that it started.
Yeah, it did start.
But did it move?
I can hardly believe this myself. Ladies and gentlemen, here it is!
It's obvious why Toyota and the US government are working so hard to keep these trucks out of the hands of terrorists. But is it any wonder why these trucks are in such high demand?
And thanks, Dan, and, well, give men free time, and this is what they do. This is Ali Habib. This is Our American Stories. More after these messages.
You want an atomic pepper, Mr. Manolino?
Nah. You guys go ahead.
I'll do it if you will, Roy.
Okay. You go first.
No, no, you go first.
No, you go first.
No, you go first.
No, you go first.
Look, I always go first.
Oh, yeah.
I always never go.
You guys
go at the same time, huh?
That sounds like a dare, Harry.
It's a double dare.
Yeah, okay. You're on.
It's not so bad.
Yeah. It's more tingly than hot.
Yeah.
This is Lee Habib, and Jesse, what were we listening to there in that sequence?
That was the famous scene from Dumb and Dumber where the guys are eating hot peppers and
that's
proceed
right.
to make a mess of the restaurant.
And by the way, the reason we have Jesse as our hot shot on the board and doing so many other things is, well, we're doing the burning question, and this week's burning question from the Wall Street Journal's Heidi Mitchell is, does spicy food cause bad dreams? And Jesse managed to have a spicy food clip and a dream song simultaneously. He deserves a bonus, and Heidi, don't you think he deserves a bonus for that segue?
Oh, definitely. Add a zero to his paycheck.
Add a zero. Hey, pipe down over there, Heidi. Who asked you? Oh, that's right. I did. Well, we're talking to the aforementioned Heidi Mitchell, who does write the Burning Question column each week for the Wall Street Journal. And by the way, on this show together, we have wrestled some of the big burning questions like, why can't you tickle yourself? And more importantly, when dogs lick you, is it going to make you sick? And by the way, we solve those problems. And if you want to hear the answers, go to OurAmericanNetwork.org. And listen, or just Google those things or Heidi's name with a Wall Street Journal in there and put dog and tickle and you're off to the races. And Heidi, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you for having me again.
Well, let's start before we get to the spicy food, which, by the way, I think we could do an hour on spicy foods and just get people's opinions, because people have hard opinions about spicy foods. But I wanted to start with dreams. And you wrote that dreams have two functions. Tell us about them.
Well, it's really interesting because there's so much that people don't know about dreams. And so I went to the Stanford University Center for Sleep Science and Medicine, and I've actually interviewed a couple of experts there across the years. And there's so many things that they just don't have the time or funding to study. But there's a lot of conflicting opinions, right? But what they do think, what science does seem to agree on, is that dreams have two functions. And the first one is that, okay, so your brain doesn't go to sleep completely all at once. So you're sort of awake. So that's one thing to just bear in mind. But the one function of dreams is that it relaxes basically your lizard brain, like the lowest, dumbest part of your brain from before you were standing upright. Mm-hmm. You probably experienced this, but when that happens, you're kind of paralyzed. Like, if you ever tried to scream in the middle of a dream, a nightmare, you can't, because that lower part of your brain that just helps movement, yep, is essentially paralyzed.
Yep.
But the second part is what's really interesting. The other function of the dream that scientists agree on is that it kicks your like executive function, the cortex, the smart part of your brain. It kicks it into overdrive. So you're doing all these crazy imaginative thinking that your logical brain would never do while you were awake, which is why they say you can maybe wake up and solve a puzzle, or because your brain really is actually working. It's like in overdrive while you're sleeping. Also, we didn't talk about it in this piece, but your brain is flooded while you sleep with extra chemicals. And so you're literally washing your brain. It's like getting washed, wake up, refresh. All those terms that we use, they're kind of logical because you're cleansing yourself.
You're cleansing it. You know, it's interesting. You have here a quote from Dr. Emmanuel Migno, and he's the director of Stanford University's Center for Sleep Sciences and Medicine. And he said this: dreaming fires your brain in random ways, forcing it to create unexpected connections that you wouldn't logically make while you're awake. This is a part of what makes humans smarter and more creative than other species. So you're basically saying those dogs that we were talking about last week that lick us, this isn't happening cognitively while they're sleeping, or to giraffes or to zebras.
Well, it can happen, actually. He had some examples of like lemurs that showed it looked like they were dreaming. And there are initially I'd had mammals in there, and he had me change it to species because he said there are some animals that do show similar behavior. So again, a lot of science, and there's not a lot of funding for studying dogs' dreams, I'm afraid.
Right, it's not a big ticket item. You also wrote about, you wrote about something I didn't know. What types of people generally remember their dreams, Heidi, and which don't?
So this is super fascinating because some people love to recall their dreams and tell you all about them. If you have a spouse, surely you've heard them. But the reason why you remember your dream is because you woke up frequently during your sleep. So you had fitful sleep. And so you're kind of, as you go deep down into sleep and you go into that dream state, well, if you come up out of it, you'll remember it. And you can remember it super vividly, right? As if it was real. Sometimes it takes you a few seconds to realize you're not being attacked by an octopus. But so those who remember their sleep, they have this fragment, what they call fragmented dream state. So you're flitting in and out of REM sleep and lighter sleep, and it's not the best kind of sleep.
Right.
So those of you that don't remember that, think that you're quote-unquote not dreaming. You're dreaming. You're just in a nice, deep sleep. You're having a nice, refreshing sleep.
Yeah, and my wife hates me because I do dig into these deep REM cycles, and she can almost never really get there. She's always worried about the next burglary, that something could happen to her daughter. And I think this is, I don't know if this is true of all men and women, but nothing can stop me from my deep sleeps, and I love them, and she doesn't get them, and it's I feel for her sometimes. Let's talk about the connection.
It's kind of amazing, right? You can have kind of crazy, fantastical experiences almost, or lifelike.
It's unbelievable. I have a whole ulterior life, and I can't wait to go to sleep and get some more. And my wife just doesn't get that. And I think once our little girl's 18, Heidi, I think she might be able to sleep fully again. But until then, there's something maternal is kicking in. We'll see. Let's talk now about the big burning question. We've got the dreams covered, Heidi. You pose in your column, does spicy food cause bad dreams? So what did you find out?
So, okay, if you're talking about the people that remember their dreams more, are the people that sleep fitfully, spicy food can elevate your core body temperature. And so if that's being, so your body cools down while you're sleeping, right? Because you're kind of shutting down some of your system. And so if your core temperature is being raised even a teensy bit by that super hot atomic pepper, then you have potential to pop out of that deep sleep. And so then you might more vividly remember your dreams. It doesn't mean that you're dreaming more vividly or that you're having more nightmares. It just means that it feels like it has the same impact because you're remembering them more. You're in and out of sleep because of that heat differential.
Right.
And also maybe digestive issues.
I think that could be it too. I mean, I was about to say it. And tell me this though, so spicy foods might keep you out of that deep sleep. What are some foods that might put you into it?
So there are, you know, everybody knows this from Thanksgiving, but there are certain foods, there are chemicals that are in foods that can trigger really great deep sleep. And tryptophan is the one that's often mentioned. It's in turkey. You know, we eat dinner on Thanksgiving at 4 p.m. I guess it's because everyone falls asleep by 8. Those are also, what's interesting is like milk and honey and turkey. There's things that you think about, kind of bedtime foods or dinner foods. And they have, some of them have these amino acids in them that are actually the precursor. So it's what would then ultimately become serotonin, MDMA, other great things that make your brain, you know, feel wonderful. So these amino acids in some of these foods like turkey and honey and, you know, they can trigger great chemicals in your brain.
Yeah, my crew, by the way, we've been trying to think about foods that can make their brains wonderful. And by the way, I need it too desperately, Heidi. So send us that list, okay? Because whatever we're eating, it ain't working for us. I wanted to hit you with this. For folks who are, you know, jolting up a lot in the nighttime and disturbing their dreams, Dr. Migno, he has some advice for them, Heidi. And by the way, I know this has got to be great stuff for a cocktail party circuit. What is that advice?
So he works with a lot of narcoleptic patients, so he has a really great database of people to work with. But he has them take a food diary and just keep track of what they're eating, when they're eating it. And he said he hasn't found any one food ever. I mean, and science has sort of never found any one food across the spectrum that affects everybody in the same way because the digestive system is so complex. But he said the really biggest thing that he has seen is large meals. Eating a large meal before you go to bed, that's going to alter your sleep cycle and you're going to maybe have a nightmare or maybe you'll feel like you're having a crazy dream and you'll wake up from it. So big, lots of food before you go to bed. So maybe there's that European style of dining that we should adhere to, you know,
yes,
eating a larger lunch and a smaller dinner.
Yes.
You can have more restful sleep.
Well, I love it. I love it, Heidi. The burning question, does spicy food cause bad dreams? The Wall Street Journal's Heidi Mitchell. Heidi, great as always having you on.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories.
Are these peppers for consuming?
I wouldn't. They're very hot.
I'm going to give it a try. Hot.
You're very brave.
Please, that was one of the tiny ones. This is how you eat it.
Don't do that, Tom.
As I went down in the river to pray, studying about that good old way, and who shall wear the starry crown? Good Lord, show me the way. Oh, sisters, let's go down, come on down. Oh, sisters, let's go down, down in the river to pray. As I went down in the river to pray, studying about that good old way, and who shall wear the robe and crown? Good Lord, show me the way. Oh, brothers, let's go down, come on down. Come on, brothers, let's go down, down in the river to pray.
This is Lee Habib with Our American Stories, and anytime we can play Alison Krauss in the right context, we do. No one does the American songbook better. Straight as an arrow. Let the song do the talking. And it's time for our regular final thought segment. This is when we hear final thoughts from people who are dying, and also final thoughts from folks about those who have passed. A eulogy, a written tribute, anything that stirs the soul. And we've taken a few from this particular gentleman who writes periodically for the Wall Street Journal because he's a doctor. And doctors know firsthand a lot about death. And this is a man who has not insulated himself from the emotional impact of patients that die. And that makes him remarkable. This week's final thoughts feature is a powerful one from Dr. E. Wesley Ely. And again, he's a professor of medicine and critical care at the Nashville VA Medical Center and the Vanderbilt University Medical Center. Dr. Ely recently told the story in the Wall Street Journal, and it was called A Swimming Pool in the ICU. He graciously recorded it for us. Let's take a listen.
Swimming pool in the ICU? You must be nuts.
The nurse's voice was almost lost among the whooshing ventilator and infusion pumps. 5 days earlier, we had admitted Benny, a Vietnam veteran, to the intensive care unit of our VA hospital in Nashville, Tennessee. Frail and wrinkled, he had a look of utter confusion and a furrowed brow that would pluck the heartstrings of even the most calloused physician. Decades spent in southern tobacco fields left him looking old enough to remember Hoover's presidency. Double pneumonia and too much sedation made him delirious. As his attending physician, I was thankful for his family. His daughter and son, Laura and Lynn, implored, "Take good care of Dad. He's all we have." "Seeing him on a ventilator is terrifying," they said, "but we believe in miracles." While loving, such a mindset could become problematic since their father's situation had the makings of a fatal illness despite our best technology. With antibiotics and fluids, Benny improved dramatically and was taken off the ventilator several days later. That same night, though, a massive stroke paralyzed his entire left side and he went back on life support. We quickly administered clot-busting medicine and he rallied, remarkably regaining movement of his left arm and leg. The following day, the intern reported, "His delirium has cleared, and he's mouthing words around the endotracheal tube despite this wicked aspiration pneumonia." I sensed an unexpected window of opportunity. We revisited Benny's life goals in light of what had happened and spoke directly about the big picture. With his children looking on, I held Benny's hand and looked him in the eyes. Choosing my words based on what I knew about his background and the family's expectation of miracles, I said, "Benny, just like tobacco plants eventually wither and wilt, so do we. You have improved in some ways, but overall, you're very weak. How can we serve you best?" The next morning, Laura and Lynn were upbeat, which confused me, since Benny looked weaker than ever. They pointed to words on a whiteboard in the room, explaining they were Benny's goals. Stable vital signs, baptism. I spotted Kelly, our charge nurse, smiling like a cat who'd swallowed a canary. In her arms, she clutched a box containing a large vinyl swimming pool. First, I made sure this was actually Benny's request and not the family's. My next thought was that we'd have a chaplain anoint him with holy water in his bed, but Laura disagreed. "Jesus wasn't sprinkled, Doc. He was dumped." A senior physician protested that the patient was on a ventilator and said he'd never seen a bedside baptism like this in 50 years of practice. There was no shortage of opinions about whether this was appropriate, safe, or even possible. A large area next to Benny's bed was cleared and an electric pump inflated the pool. When a large multi-person bucket brigade proved too difficult, an engineer rigged dialysis tubing to circulate the pool with a stream of warm water. Benny was then hoisted high into the air via a patient transfer lift. And the ventilator was unplugged before he was lowered into the pool. Lynn gently took his father, the man who'd showed him how to farm, into his arms. Following the cherished Christian tradition, he slowly submerged Benny's head completely under the water, saying, "Dad, I baptize you in the name of the God the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit."
Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved.
On cue, the palliative care social worker began belting out "Amazing Grace." The rest of us stood frozen in time.
I once was lost.
First out of the water was blue corrugated ventilator tubing. Then his face appeared around the breathing tube. Benny's huge smile seemed to say, "Better late than never." When he died a week later, Laura implored me to tell other people about her dad, hoping his experience would show them that we can all become strong through our weakness. In fact, I have seen scores of patients and families use profound outer wasting as a catalyst for deep inner renewal. The most two important frames of our life are birth and death. We typically associate baptism with the former, yet Jesus spoke of his death as a baptism to indicate the formative next step that dying represents for our journey. The ICU team's bold yet careful response to Benny's unusual request taught me an enduring lesson regarding sympathy versus empathy. Sympathy is feeling sorry for someone. Empathy is feeling with someone. In all the surrounding insanity of the hospital that day, diving deeply into Benny's life through his baptism on the breathing machine allowed all of us to be reborn too. Being with him in that pool and rising with him out of it, we walked into others' lives better prepared to serve them.
And it doesn't get better than that, folks, and that's why we love running these stories. You got to hold back a tear listening to that. And I love that definition of empathy and sympathy. You know, Bono said of Johnny Cash when he was buried, "Johnny Cash doesn't sing to the damned, he sings with the damned." And I think that's why Cash was so loved. And God bless the folks who did this amazing thing. And most folks in most hospitals just wouldn't have bothered. Too difficult. Splash a little water on his head. That's it. That's all we got. We'll end here as we started our final thought segment. Alison Krauss.
Studying about that good old way, and who shall wear the starry crown, good Lord, show me the way. Oh, sinners, let's go down, let's go down, come on down. Oh, sinners, let's go down, down in the river to pray. As I went down in the river to pray, studying about that good old way,
this is Our American Stories. Now we're going to bring you one of the more powerful speeches that you've ever heard. And we love bringing you old speeches from speech banks. Great American Rhetoric. You could go on that site and never leave it. Great speeches recorded from probably the early 1920s forward. And then renditions of old speeches that one doesn't have any tape on, but actors and others have recorded for the public domain. And this one we got our hands from off of YouTube. And, well, we sell all kinds of incredible products each and every day here in this great country. But we don't sell the important product that matters most. America. American values, the ideas of this great country, and the founding principles. This speech was given by a guy who has a profound appreciation of this thing called the American experiment, so much so that he named his company after it, Amway, which stands for American Way. His name, Rich DeVos. Here he is delivering his Selling America speech in, of all places, Canada, in 1966, during the very early days of Amway.
You see, it's not what we've done, but we believed in people. And so today there's 80,000 people in Canada and the United States who sell our products. And all they've said is, give me a chance to get ahead and I'll do it. And they join us by the thousands every month. And so for those people who you will meet and who will be telling you that opportunity doesn't exist, I want you to stand up and say, I don't believe it. Because I happen to know that opportunity is greater today in this country than ever. And believe me, friends, there's more opportunity in business than any or all of you will ever be able to take advantage of. The challenges in industry are great. I keep reading about the fact that the kids in college today go into the social field. You know, they want to work for the welfare of others. Well, if you got any guts, you'll get in business. Because we provide more welfare than anybody else. We provide employment for 72 million people. That's what we do. You see, all these people who are talking about trying to help somebody else are only doing it because they don't have the guts to face the real challenge, which is taking on somebody else. And so they run around paying patty cake and say, well, I'll hold your hand. I'll help you. Help you nothing. Give them a job. That's what will help them the most. I like people who go to college, and I got a couple of friends who go. I'm all for it, but I get tired of these boys and their two-bit theories sitting over there, always telling me how important it is to help people, you know, and telling these kids it's all just the love of somebody else. Well, you better love them or you won't help them. But I'll tell you, you can help a lot more people our way than you can their way. Today, our plant covers 180,000 square feet on a 250-acre site. We have 500 employees, 80,000 distributors. We sell $36 million worth of, you know what? Soap. And you know what they say? Why? Didn't you ever hear of Lever Brothers? Did you ever hear of Blue Cheer, Green Cheer, Brown Cheer, No Cheer, Does, Doesn't, Didn't, Wouldn't, Shouldn't, Could, You Name It. Now, you talk about free enterprise. You talk about saying a simple thing with an idea. You say, I'll tell you what, lady. I'm going to bring the soap to you instead of making you go to the store and get it. And that's all we did. And that's the great thing of our two countries, that it allows people to still apply such technique.
Then Rich powerfully contrasts the socialist and communist regimes on the rise at the time to the free enterprise system of this country.
And this is what you're going to hear, you know. Why, this is a rotten society today, folks. Did you know that? That dog-eat-dog free enterprise system. Why? Well, that's out of date. This is the age of socialism. This is a new age where we're concerned for our fellow man. This dog-eat-dog trying to outdo the other guy and make a better product and outsell him. That's not anymore. That's what millions are saying in this country, aren't they? But you see, what disproves all that is that despite this so-called selfish attitude we're supposed to have, last year the American people reached in their pockets and gave $10 billion away to help somebody else. No, you see, the average American that I know is concerned for the welfare of his fellow Americans. And he works towards that end and he gives to the causes that will help them. And so the next time somebody tells you our system is not conscious of the welfare of others, then you remind them that it's more conscious of it than any other group of people on earth. I don't find any Red Cross or United Community Fund campaigns going on behind the Iron Curtain these days. I don't see them enjoying the things we have, and neither do you.
And indeed, after a trip to Haiti, I watched American pastors, American businessmen, Americans of every stripe on what would typically be a summer vacation, getting on a plane to another plane to another plane to spend their days making sure that people in peril were fed. And that's the American spirit. And by the way, there were a couple of Europeans there, but when I talked to the people on the ground, they said there's just, we wouldn't be alive but for Americans. We'd be dead. And so Rich DeVos is just making great points here. In this final clip of his speech, Rich talks about what makes this country so great, all the different roles we all play, working freely together, voluntarily, and what we can do to make it even better.
The next time that fella comes by who picks up the garbage at your house, he's a fellow American who's using his talent to do what he can do, that he too is a part of the great mainstream of American life. I had an interesting experience because I like garbage men. But I went out for 4 weeks in a row. This fellow comes by at 6:30 in the morning because I wanted to meet him. I said, "Hi, how are you this morning? Just came out to tell you I appreciate your coming." He looked at me and he said, "Are you just getting up or are you just coming in?" Wasn't sure. I said, "No, I just came out to say hello. I said, I appreciate you coming by." Now, if you don't think you appreciate his coming by, you just let him skip you a couple times. And you'll find out how important he is in your life. You know, about the fourth time I went out there, I said, "I'm just come out and say hello again." I said, "I really mean it. I appreciate your coming. Do you realize how important the work is that you do? What it does for the sanitation of this community? How it protects the health and welfare of all the people?" He says, "Well, I'll be damned." He said, "I've been picking up garbage for years, man. Nobody ever told me that." And I say to you, isn't it too bad that a fellow American who's doing what he's able to do has had no one tell him how important his work is? He says, "You know," he says, "you're one in a million." Well, I don't want to be one in a million. And I ask you to join me in a crusade of respectability for all your fellow Americans. I marvel at the PhD who works for us, and he's a wonderful man. I look at the chemists we have, and I notice how helpless they are when it comes to emptying the wastebasket. And then I look at the people who come to work and work on the line, and I look at the school bus drivers, and we say, "Why, he's just a bus driver." And the other people say, "Well, he's just a businessman. He's just a salesman." We eradicate the words "just" from your vocabulary. Nobody is just to anything. He's a man or a woman doing what he knows how to do best. That's the real sign. So if a guy fixes your car, remember to greet him. Remember to thank him. And if all of us will begin to do this, we can change America. We can break down the barriers between "I'm better than you." There's too much of it.
And there is. And Pat Williams, by the way, who does our leadership series and has written more books on leadership than anybody, and what a career he had. He helped co-found the Orlando Magic with the DeVos family. And he wrote a book called How to Be Like Rich DeVos, because it was just one of his heroes. And here's what he wrote. It's a great little excerpt. "During the turbulent and rebellious 1960s, Rich spoke to a student audience on a college campus. He explained that the American economic system is actually the best way to create an environment of compassion and generosity toward the poor. As he spoke, Rich mentioned the car that he drove was a Cadillac. This brought one impassioned student to his feet with a question. 'Mr. DeVos,' the young man said, 'if you really have compassion for the poor, why don't you get rid of that Cadillac? Why don't you get a cheap, basic transportation car that will get you where you want to go without the expense and luxury of that car?' He says back, 'Suppose I do as you say and I get rid of my Cadillac. Exactly how will the poor have more if I have less?' 'Isn't it obvious?' the student asked. 'You can take the money you save by driving a cheaper car, and you can give it to the poor.' 'You're mistaken,' Rich said. 'If you think that the poor will have more if the rich have less, in reality, if the rich have less, then everyone has less, including the poor.' The student looked skeptically. 'I understand your skepticism,' Rich continued, 'but I can easily illustrate my point. When I purchased my Cadillac, I paid a certain amount of money for it. Some of that money went to the dealer. Some of it to the car salesman who sold it to me. Some went to General Motors Corporation. Some went into the paychecks of the assembly line workers who built it. If I had not purchased that Cadillac, those workers would have been poorer. Every product or service I buy puts money into circulation in this economy. The more money circulates in the economy, the more jobs there are, and the more opportunities there are for the poor to get out of poverty. At that moment, a light of understanding dawned on the student's face. Of course, Rich continued, charitable giving is important. When people are starving or homeless, they need help. But charity is a short-term solution. The only true way to lift the poor out of poverty and give them a future is to educate them, inspire them, and give them access to opportunities only a free market society can afford. This is Lee Habib, Rich DeVos, Selling America. Our American Stories. Go to OurAmericanNetwork.org to catch all of our work. American Stories, and we love to talk about music on this show. And we've done a bunch of segments on the story of a song, and we wanted to rip through a few of them for you. Every once in a while, we go back into the archives and do a mashup and sort of put together a best of in case you missed some of the things that we do. A while back, we dissected Pink Floyd's Another Brick in the Wall. One of the producers on the album got the idea to have kids to record the chorus behind the song that was stuck in neutral in the recording studio. The now-grown kids from Another Brick in the Wall session talk about being led around the corner from their school to Pink Floyd Studios to record the song.
Hustled together, sneaked out the school, like, as quickly as possible.
Marched along the road, round the corner, and we were all sort of, it was a lot of buzzing, you know, what's going on, what are we doing, you know, what's this all about? And then the next thing we realised, we turned up and we were at Pink Floyd's recording studio, which was literally round the corner from the school.
What the children didn't realise was that their maverick music teacher was about to make them the stars of one of the most famous songs of all time.
And it was like, wow, you know, there were sort of carpets on the floors and walls, and you could see huge mixing desks.
And they gave us the words, they played us the track.
And we were all, oh, yeah, that's a great song. We'll have some of that. Let's sing that.
Well, Roger Waters talks about the first time he heard the song with the kids on the recording. It still gives him the goosebumps.
I remember sitting in producer's workshop on Sunset Boulevard in Los Angeles, and this package arriving, and it was the tape Back with the Kids. And they threw all the faders up, pressed play, and I still have hairs standing up on my arms and everywhere, just remembering the sound, what it sounded like when it came out, hearing those kids sing.
We don't need no education. We don't need no school control.
I was just so excited.
Just another brick in the wall.
And another brick in the wall with the children singing.
Teachers leave the kids alone.
there you have it. What a great story about a song. It was just stuck in neutral with the grown-ups singing. And so they got some kids from the old school that they'd all gone to with those Cockney accents, marched them into Abbey Road Studios. And back in the day, you had to send that acetate tape all the way back to Los Angeles, and history was made. Now we want to talk about Dick Dale's Miser Lou. If you have ever seen Quentin Tarantino's Pulp Fiction, you could probably even hum the song notes by memory. Here, our producer Jesse Edwards sheds some light on the history of that instrumental hit that you probably don't know.
Dick Dale's first full-length album was Surfer's Choice in 1962. The album was picked up by Capitol Records and distributed nationally. Dale soon began appearing on The Ed Sullivan Show and in films where he played his signature single, Miser Lou. People of my age probably know Miser Lou best from the Pulp Fiction soundtrack. But what a lot of people don't know is that it's a traditional song from the Eastern Mediterranean region. The earliest recordings of the song are a 1919 Egyptian composition called Bent Miser and a 1927 Greek composition influenced by Middle Eastern music.
This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. We're going to continue with this hour. We're going to cover Light My Fire, Gimme Shelter, Cats in the Cradle, and a great, great classic from Billy Joel, Lullaby. When we come back, the story of songs. Some of our best stories shortened, edited, compiled, condensed, stuck into the blender for your enjoyment. And again, this is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. The story of the song. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. When the song Gimme Shelter was recorded in 1969, the Rolling Stones were having a hard time going back and forth from London to L.A. There was something missing in this song, but the band found help from a backup singer that they'd never heard of. She'd never heard of them. She's the one with a haunting voice in that song, and her name, Mary Clayton. Let's hear from her and the guys and the band about this iconic recording.
Great studio. Boy, did we have some time in the studio. So So it was like very late at night, and I was very, you know, a little pregnant. Had curlers and the whole thing in my head, getting ready to go to bed. And we got a call, Mary, there's a group of guys in town called the Rolling Somebodies, and they're from England, and they need somebody that will sing with them. They picked me up with silk pajamas on, a mink coat, and a Chanel scarf on my head.
We said it would be wonderful if a woman sang this part about that I'd written about rape, murder, and all this. It was in the middle of the night, and we thought, well, we would love to have a woman sing this part. I didn't know her, and from Adam. And then she turned up in her curlers, she was in bed, and she got out of bed. And, you know, it was a kind of raunchy part to sing.
I said, what? Rape, murder? It's just a shot away. I started to sing, oh, yeah, it's a shot away, it's a shot away, with Mick.
She sings the lyrics right along me, and with a lot of personality, which is what was needed.
What I liked was that she could sing. She was able to be Mary. She didn't have to bring it down.
I said, you want to do another one? I said, sure, I'll do another one.
I mean, she just did it like a couple of times, you know.
So I said to myself, I'm going to do another one. I'm going to blow them out of this room. I went in again and I did that pass on the part that says, rape, murder, just a shot away. So I had to go up another octave.
Hey!
Rape, murder, it's just a shot away, it's just a shot away. Rape, murder, yeah, it's just a shot away, it's just a shot away. Rape, murder, it's just a shot away, it's just a shot away, yeah, 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 yeah.
You know, you do these things at sort of 2 a.m. and then you come in the next day and you go, yeah, that's good.
Yeah. I don't hear a hand clap.
It doesn't get better. I mean, we play that. We've got to play that at least a few times a year because a nobody comes in with curling irons on her head in a mink coat in the middle of the night. No one knew anybody. And it's one of the greatest recordings in the history of rock and roll, hands down. And she made it so. Without that voice, it ain't a song. And they knew it. And it was so good of Mick Jagger to throw himself into that video and that documentary about background singers. Just a terrific, terrific piece of work all the way around. And now we're going to take you to a master class at the University of Pennsylvania. Billy Joel does this periodically. He just shows up at a college with a baby grand, and people ask him questions, and then he tells them about the mechanics of songwriting. And a woman got up in the audience and asked Billy Joel about the song Lullaby.
All right, so I had this melody. Which is how I write songs. I wrote the music first. She goes, Daddy, what happens when you die? So I said, oh, man, okay. And I told her what I really believed. And what I really believe is what happens when you die is you go into other people's hearts. That you never really go away. You go into the rest of the people that you knew. You go into the rest of their lives. They take them with you. So, but also this was during a time when her mom and I were splitting up. So this was like a double-pronged thing, like, Daddy, you're going to leave me. And I said, I'll never leave you. I will never leave you. I'll never go away. I will never, never, ever leave you. So it was a tough answer, you know, in both respects. So I'm trying to remember when I was writing it.
So he struggles a little bit more, and he's actually tearing up. You can tell this is a really hard song for him to sing, and this is the thing about music in the end and a story. And think about this. He's really trying to solve a problem. That's what brings him to this song. So let's go a little bit further down in this masterclass. Here's Billy Joel again.
Good night, Mike.
these questions for another day. I think I know what you've been asking me. I think you know what I've been trying to say. I promised I would never leave you, and you should always know. Wherever you may go, no matter where you are, I never will be far away.
And there you have it, Billy Joel answering his little girl's question with a song. He continues through the second verse, and as he gets through the end, he has almost a breakdown. He starts to cry. He starts to pull away from the microphone. It's so emotional. It's so intimate. He never gives this explanation of the song when he's at Madison Square Garden. But here it's just him, a keyboard, and a couple of thousand people. Well, he comes back to the keyboards and shares the stunning final verse of this song again for his little girl.
Good night, my angel, now it's time to dream. And dream how wonderful your life will be. Someday your child may cry, and if you sing this lullaby, then in your heart there will always be a part of me. Someday we'll all be gone, but lullabies go on and on. They never die, that's how you and I will.
A master song, a master songwriter, shifting it to the future. The little girl singing this lullaby to her little girl. That's what art can do. Take us across time, across generations, race, class, ethnicity. This is Lee Habib, our American stories, Billy Joel's story to his little girl, his little girl's story to her little girl. More after this. And there you have it. And by the way, what was coming up was another classic from Billy Joel, Downeaster Alexa. And once you start that song, you can't stop. So rather than me talk, let's end with another classic Joel story about a fisherman in the Long Island Sound who can't afford to live where he fishes. Another beauty.
Well, I'm on the Downeaster Alexa, and I'm cruising through Block Island Sound. But tonight I am Nantucket bound. We took on diesel back in Montauk yesterday. Left this morning from the Bell and Gardner's Bay. Like all the locals here, I've had to sell my home. Too proud to leave, I worked my fingers to the bone so I could.
This is Our American Stories. And we're putting together an assembly of some of our best work over the past few months. Material you like, material our staff loves, and our families, too. And that's our audience. You, us, and our people. And we love the Medal of Honor stories we did around July 4th and Memorial Day. And one in particular just killed us. And that is Sal Junta. And he's the first living recipient of the Medal of Honor since the Vietnam War. And let's go to the White House presentation to hear just what he did to earn this medal.
Specialist Salvatore A. Junta distinguished himself conspicuously by gallantry and intrepidity at the risk of his life above and beyond the call of duty in action with an armed enemy in the Korangal Valley, Afghanistan, on October 25, 2007. While conducting a patrol as team leader with Company B, 2nd Battalion Airborne, 503rd Infantry Regiment, Specialist Junta and his team were navigating through harsh terrain when they were ambushed by a well-armed and well-coordinated insurgent force. While under heavy enemy fire, Specialist Junta immediately sprinted towards cover and engaged the enemy. Seeing that his squad leader had fallen and believing that he had been injured, Specialist Junta exposed himself to withering enemy fire and raced towards his squad leader, helped him to cover, and administered medical aid. While administering first aid, enemy fire struck Specialist Junta's body armor and his secondary weapon. Without regard to the ongoing fire, Specialist Junta engaged the enemy before prepping and throwing grenades, using the explosions for cover in order to conceal his position. Attempting to reach additional wounded fellow soldiers who were separated from the squad, Specialist Junta and his team encountered a barrage of enemy fire that forced them to the ground. The team continued forward, and upon reaching the wounded soldiers, Specialist Junta realized that another soldier was still separated from the element. Specialist Junta then advanced forward on his own initiative. As he crested the top of a hill, he observed two insurgents carrying away an American soldier. He immediately engaged the enemy, killing one and wounding the other. Upon reaching the wounded soldier, he began to provide medical aid as his squad caught up and provided security. Specialist Junta's unwavering courage, selflessness, and decisive leadership while under extreme enemy fire were integral to his platoon's ability to defeat an enemy ambush and recover a fellow American soldier from the enemy. Specialist Salvatore A. Junta's extraordinary heroism and selflessness above and beyond the call of duty are in keeping with the highest traditions of military service and reflect great credit upon himself, Company B, 2nd Battalion Airborne, 503rd Infantry Regiment, and the United States Army.
In 2011, Staff Sergeant Sal Junta, he's now been promoted, is on the David Letterman Show. And Letterman asks him what made him go above and beyond the call of duty. Let's listen.
None of it is me. I think training plays a big role in it because we train how we fight. This wasn't the first time we've been shot at. It was the most intense fire we've taken from the closest area. But everything we do in the military, you don't do it for yourself. You do it to the person to the left of you, to the person to the right of you. And as long as you have them on your left and right, you're not going to fail them because they won't fail you. And whatever has to happen will happen because we're going to do it together.
And why does someone sign up for a job so dangerous? Here is Sal responding to David Letterman asking that question. His answer, it'll surprise you.
I was working at Ellis Golf Course, and I was also working at Subway. Mm-hmm. And I really had no plan on going into the military.
Right.
I was mopping the floor one night after Subway closed, and I heard a radio commercial come on about, you know, come and see the recruiters and get a free T-shirt.
Right.
I wear T-shirts, so I'll take it for T-shirt. I'm a sucker about free stuff.
Yeah.
So so I went down to see the recruiter in Lindale Mall to pick up my free T-shirt. And of course, you know, they give you the spiel. And part of what the recruiter told me was he just kind of laid it out for me right then and there. He's like, hey, we're a country at war. We're at war in Afghanistan. We're at war in Afghanistan, or Afghanistan and Iraq. And I'm sitting there listening to him. There's parachutes hanging from the ceiling, and like everyone looks all sharp in their uniform. I'm like, okay, you know, he told me a little more, and I took the free T-shirt and I left. And probably within the next 10 days, things just kind of slowly sunk in. Like, I'm 18 years old. I'm a male. I can jump out of planes and they're going to pay me money. I can run around and shoot guns. They're going to pay me money. And for sure, I'm going to get a chance to see the world. Mm-hmm. So I told my parents and I went and signed up.
Still have the T-shirt?
I got tons of them now because they're what we do PT in every morning. Yeah.
And that is the American soldier, folks. That's it. And if you've met them and you know them, and the ladies too, it's just that self-effacing Americanism that just pops through the microphone. And listen to that audience just laugh and clap. And now we turn our attention to some of the material we culled from former Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi's daughter, Alexandra, when in 2011 she decided to go around the country and talk to people who had recently been sworn in as immigrants to this country from all over the world and become naturalized citizens. Let's take a listen to some of these stories. It's remarkable.
In America, they strive for removing barriers and discrimination of deaf individuals. We are given an equal opportunity.
In Russia, it's an embarrassment. I could not show people in public that I was deaf. I had to keep it hidden. I love it that here in America, I am in America, and I'm so proud to be deaf. I am who I am, and I love it. Being deaf is great. I'm afraid of nothing.
I'm afraid of nothing. Next up is a woman who grew up under the communist regime in Hungary.
My husband and I fled the communist country of Hungary, and it's not that it was very bad living under communist government, but now that we know how different another life, another side is, it was very bad. Under communist government, you had one choice: to get a Russian-made car. You had to pay half of it up front, and when a car arrived, you haven't even have a chance to pick for a color. You hated a yellow car, but by the time you're supposed to pick up your car, if there was only a yellow car on the lot, you had to take it, otherwise your number thrown back for 3 years again. So for the rest of your life, you saved up your money for a car, and you hated a yellow car, but you're going to have to drive a yellow car because that was the only car available.
Yep, not a lot of choice. And by the way, listen to Mike Rose's story about Boris Yeltsin and pudding pops, or puddin' pops, and how that changed his thinking about so much, and particularly about centrally planned governments and economies. Next up, former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, herself an immigrant from Czechoslovakia, who became a U.S. citizen in 1957. Let's take a listen.
My father asked for political asylum, and we lived in London during World War II, and the British were very kind to us. And then we came to the United States in 1948, and my father used to describe the real difference. He said, when we were in England, people couldn't have been nicer. They said, your country's been taken over by a terrible dictator. You're welcome here. What can we do to help you? But when are you going home? When we came to the United States, people were very, very nice, and they said, your country's been taken over by a terrible system, and you're welcome here. What can we do to help you, and when will you become a citizen?
And what a difference. And we had so many more stories. Go to OurAmericanNetwork.org and catch the July 4th special. One particular one that caught our attention was an Iranian lesbian who talked about what her life sentence was living there as someone who was gay and what it meant to her to be able to come to this country and live as the person she was. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. More after these messages. This is Our American Stories, and we do a lot of generosity segments. And Nate Scott who has now become a regular, gave us his very first segment having to do with, well, an odd, quirky story about generosity, I think, kinda, sorta, with this submission, his very first submission to Our American Stories. Take a listen.
This is a story about one of my best friends, Riley Flaherty. Riley recently lost his wallet. It's a bummer, but it happens. He was at a Wilco concert at King's Theater in Brooklyn, and after the show, he took an Uber back home to Manhattan. And as soon as he got home, he realized he didn't have his wallet. Riley had a trip the next morning. He really wanted the thing, so he had the driver take him all the way back. He searched the theater, but nothing. Now it's 3 a.m, and Riley, dejected, heads back to Manhattan. He has some cash lying around, so he's able to go on the trip, but his wallet's gone. And so he does what you do when you lose a wallet. He cancels his credit cards. He actually was waiting on a new driver's license, so he got one of those, and he bought a new wallet. End of story. Or so you'd think. Because after that, a miracle happened. Well, a sort of miracle. A very New York miracle. 2 weeks after he lost his wallet, Riley received a plain white envelope in the mail. His name was written in shaky handwriting on it. And inside was his license, his credit cards, and a note. The note read, "Dear Riley Flaherty, I found your wallet, and your driver's license had your address, so here's your credit cards and other important stuff. I kept the cash because I needed weed, the Metro card because, well, the fare's $2.75 now, and the wallet because it's kind of cool. Enjoy the rest of your day. Toodles. Anonymous." I've never been so conflicted about a nice gesture, Riley told me. The cash, gone. The wallet, gone. The Metro card, gone. But 2 weeks later, returned in a plain white envelope, a driver's license, and his credit cards. I had already gone to get a new license, and had already gotten all my cards replaced, said Riley. So basically, it was useless to me. He did have this story, though, and no one can take that away from him.
And that's the thing about stories. No one can take them away from you. And now we close out this hour talking about a couple of people we bumped into doing our American Dreamers story. And, well, one girl named Jane Johnson, she was living in the very tough neighborhood outside Chicago. And, well, life was tough for her. And, well, take a listen to this story, because she's now a machinist at Atlas Machine Shop working with a man named Zach Model, a fourth-generation owner of the family business. Hear their story of hardship, hard work, job creation, and opportunity. They both join us now. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having us.
Let's start with the worker first, and let's learn a little bit about you, Jane, because when I hear the name Jane, I don't think machinist, generally. Talk to me about your life and what led you to become this thing called a machinist.
Okay. Well, I was born on the west side of Chicago. I lived and was raised by my grandmother. Unfortunately, my mom, she had schizophrenia, so she wasn't able to care for me as well. So I lived with her until I was 13. And once I became 13, my grandmother, she became ill with liver cancer. And after she passed away, I moved to my great aunt's, which is my grandmother's sister's house, also on the west side of Chicago. And from there, I've grown. I've graduated from high school. I went to college for a couple of years, came back because my aunt was a little sick and she needed help. And from there, I was at home, and I realized, hey, I have to contribute. I have to do something. I have to contribute to society somehow. So I had a counselor, and she gave me a little bit of information about TMA, which is a program that teamed up with this church called Bethel New Life, technology manufacturing aligned with TMA, and I attended classes there. I got really excited because I always had a love for just anything I can get my hands on, being technical, anything that I can basically rip apart and find out how it works. So that program was perfect for me. I went to school for a couple of weeks and graduated. And yeah, after graduation, Zach reached out to me, and from there, that's all that.
The rest is history.
Yep.
And Jane, it's interesting because when you start talking about taking stuff apart and putting it back together, I got a little girl who loves the same thing, and I can try and put a little bow on her head and put a dress. She ain't having any of it. She wants to learn how to take apart a gun. She wants to learn how to take apart anything that moves. And I just don't want to get in the way. Now, here's what's interesting. You're now working in a place doing something you love. You don't have a college degree. This is, by the way, something we talk over and over with people about. College just isn't right for everybody. We're not here to slam colleges. We have a great sponsor that's a college. But for you, it just didn't make sense. Talk a little bit about that and how this training changed your life.
Definitely, the training has changed my life in so many ways. Number one, I have gotten a leg up in society thanks to this training. So without having a degree, some people might feel that they won't be able to contribute to society or do anything for themselves, and they'll just be falling by the wayside. But no, training, it actually gave me a little bit of knowledge and a little bit more something to work with than the average Joe. And, yeah, manufacturing, the whole industry has just brightened my eyes and made me believe that there is still a way for me as a little bit more than a regular Joe, I would say.
Zach, you're the fourth generation owner of Atlas Tool and Die Works. Tell us about your family, how this all started, and tell us about your business now.
Yeah, so I'm the fourth generation family business here at Atlas Tool. My great-grandfather started it in 1918 in downtown Chicago. And, you know, initially we built dies and fixtures for the burgeoning industry as the Industrial Revolution was kind of happening in the early 1900s. And we made it through two world wars and a couple other wars. And over the years we kept, I think the key to our success at our business was we kept pivoting and transitioning to where the opportunity was. And again, in the beginning we were just tools and dies and fixtures. And in the 50s we added stamping in response to customer demand. And then in the 70s, EDM technology. And every decade, we layered on another set of technology. We put some more tools on our belt, so to speak. And what we really sell is manufacturing services. So whatever custom parts and pieces our customers need, that's what we need to have the services and the technology to supply. So, you know, we've been fortunate for almost 100 years to keep pivoting here and fortunate to get to work together as a family. I work with my father. My two sisters are in the business and very blessed to have that opportunity. And I'm blessed to have such wonderful employees like Jane and my other team members. You know, the average tenure at my company, while we're growing and expanding, still the average tenure is over 20 years.
Most, oh my goodness,
people that come here, they stay here and they work here, they have a career for a lifetime. And I so value those people because that's really what's made us successful over the years.
Of course. And you know that you keep those people as testimony to management, because good management retains people. And to retain people in an ever-changing environment is no duck walk, Zach. How do you do that? Because change is tough. And sometimes people just want to resist change, but it sounds like your team understands that you either change together or you die together.
Well, that is tough, and we've had a few close calls over the years. You know, my father and I recently bought out his cousins 2 years ago, and I think those were two people, nice people, but they had a different opportunity, a different belief in change, and change is hard. So if you're not willing to embrace it and to modernize and to keep going where the opportunity is, you will miss the boat here. And I think, you know, in terms of keeping people, you know, we treat people fairly, treat people well, treat them like we would like to be treated. And I like to say, you know, my team and Jane, maybe you can attest to this, you know, I work as hard as I expect my team to work. You know, I'm not the owner that goes out golfing all day and tells my people to go and take care of their work. No, I'm here working with them. And on Saturday, I'm here too. And I'm here late. And I come in early. So I try to set the example for my team, and I expect the same from them. I expect the best from them, and I expect to give the best because we want to win together. It's a team. It really is a team effort. So, you know, everybody from the people sweeping the floor to the people taking the orders and managing the customer, we are all important. Nothing functions without each one of those jobs getting done. So you know, I believe in that, and we've tried to reward people as we could when we were making money, when we're profitable, when we're doing well. We've certainly shared the rewards with the team over the years, and I think that's why people come and stay. But now, you know, it is time to our business is changing again, and it is time to attract that next generation of workers, and Jane is a great example of hopefully what will be the next generation of the workforce will be here for another 20, 30, 40 years.
Well, that's fantastic. And, you know, a book that we had interviewed the author of, a book called Team of Teams, we interviewed Stanley McChrystal. And we took a couple of calls. And what was interesting is a couple of guys who trained under him said, you know, you were the best boss a guy could ever have. You were up with us, you trained with us, and you went to sleep and we went to sleep. And I think that is always a sign of leadership, that you don't do anything. You would not do anything you didn't ask your own people to do. And that's just a sign of great leadership. Zach, you're in Chicago. How many employees do you have in your company?
So we've been growing, but as of the last count that I heard at Atlas, we're approaching 74 or 75 employees. We have, I think, about 5 temps right now, so a total about 80 here. We have 2 other related businesses where we employ some more people. So in total, we're getting close to 90 employees between all the businesses here in Chicago.
90 employees, and one of them, young Jane, who he plucked off the line of a young graduating corps of workers at the age of 18 and now making a good living and looking to own a home of her own. The American dream, alive and well in the city of Chicago, though harder and harder to make it, as we learned from Zach. This is Our American Stories.